Hello and welcome to the Gambling Files podcast, the podcast that likes to think of itself as a morning person when that actually just means it's more annoying earlier in the day. I'm one of your hosts, John Bruford. I'm joined by your other host, Mr. Fintan Costello. Fintan, hello.
Hello, John.
Fintan, if you had to list our sponsors in order of favoritism, who would be the top, do you think?
Oh, it's easy. I'm an affiliate. I know exactly who to rank my favorites.
Well, thank goodness, because I struggle to choose.
This is what I do. Whatever you need, what I've got in stock. I've got a story about that. Anyway. I would say our number one platinum VIP sponsor would be Clarion Gaming.
Clarion Gaming, organizers of ICE and the IGB affiliate show and the all of that jazz.
And the IGB affiliate awards, which are coming up soon.
They're around the showtime.
It's around the showtime. Okay.
But they've just closed entries for that. But we should have Stephen on next week, I think, to
Brilliant.
Talk affiliates.
Oh, let's do that. That'd be really good. And then obviously there's tables for sale. So it's a great night out. And it's a good way to, because it's done around the affiliate conference and stuff as well. Everyone's in town. Book your table. Get your partners on it.
Your
affiliates. So I had a table booked. Had a table booked, paid for one, shortlisted, won, but I wasn't there. COVID got me. Couldn't go.
It's a decent excuse, to be fair.
Devastated.
So what year was that? It would have to be last year.
Yeah, it was last year.
Hmm.
I know. Could have done without that. That was a bad one. But look, it's a great night out. Would highly recommend it.
You could go to next year's.
Yeah, could do. It's a good idea, actually.
There's literally no reason not to. They haven't
good
got
point.
A best podcast category, but they might have for the year after. So we've got to keep fucking grinding and grinding at this until we get some kind of peer recognition.
Because that's what I'm all about. Other people's opinions.
we're only human, Fintan.
I know.
There's only so long you can shout into the abyss for.
That's a good point. So Clarion, great bunch, great events, a lot going on, and we'll have some more Clarion people on.
Your top two sponsors. Clarion Gaming in one.
Who's number one? Number two would be BeWise Media.
Oh, they sound nice.
They are nice. Really smart bunch. Many strings to their bow. So Clarion does a lot of stuff, right? Now maybe it's an interesting parallel between two. So BeWise Media, their background is managing media sales for large sports publishers. So they sit on a lot of exclusive inventory, global exclusive inventory on sports, football websites, that kind of thing. So if you're an operator and you're looking to buy media, particularly in difficult to reach markets, definitely talk to BeWise Media. They've also got paid media channels. They've got a really smart stuff, like the custom creative stuff they're doing, super, super smart. Basically looks native, much better click-through rates than your traditional kind of banner ads and stuff like that. So really, really smart bunch. They've got a lot going on. They've been doing it for years, and they've been delivering. So, yeah.
I think also it's probably worth saying that it's worth following Sebastian Paris on LinkedIn because
he's good value.
He really is. He really has got a lot of interesting stuff to say. Sometimes about marketing, sometimes about events. But I mean that's how we ended up with him on the podcast, wasn't it?
It is.
He was saying something salient about an event.
It was. So, yeah, that would be our sponsors.
Well, great. And thank you for enlightening me on that. I appreciate it.
What we should also say is there are more sponsorship spots available.
There are. I mean, Clarion Gaming is our exclusive event sponsor.
Yeah, so we've got a platform sponsorship available.
Mm.
We've got a payment provider sponsorship available.
Yeah, we've got a legal services sponsorship available.
Responsible Gaming.
There's probably some other ones as well that we just haven't thought of yet.
I'm sure we can create the categories. Bit like an awards. Sure. There's something for everybody.
The Gambling Files Podcast Awards. Because the one thing I've looked at this industry and thought, Fintan, is there aren't enough awards.
More awards, more events. Because I'm looking at my LinkedIn feed. I'm looking at my LinkedIn feed and it's just like, oh, now I'm off to... Everyone's just back from GTE and then they're off to Sigma somewhere else. And they're like, there's a lot of events. I don't know how people do.
But unlike back in the day, they're mostly quite good events. And back in the day, at least some of them were shit.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's almost like digital streaming services. There's too much good content.
I finished Mr. In Between.
How'd you like it?
Brilliant.
Told you.
Brilliant.
Isn't it strange that you never heard of it before?
Never heard of it before. But it's that just great TV.
It's phenomenal. I mean, it's so well written, beautifully performed.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just incredibly well put together.
Like the acting throughout is phenomenal.
Yeah, it is a stunningly good series. And yet... Mm-hmm. I have yet to meet anybody that's even heard of it, much less watched it. It's bonkers. Yeah. But anyway, so anybody listening, if you've got Disney Plus, Mr. In Between, it is well worth your time. 26 episodes, 25 minutes an episode. It's worth the investment. Trust me. It does get a little fruity with the language.
Very Australian. Very Australian.
Very Australian. And any Australians out there, you know what I'm talking about.
But it's probably the most real Australian depiction I've actually seen. Because normally it's like, it's the beach and it's Bondi and it's, you know, surfing and all that kind
Have
of stuff.
Have you not seen Snowtown?
No, I haven't.
Don't watch Snowtown. I'm not joking.
Okay.
Don't watch it.
All right.
It will. You will stop sleeping. It's one of the nastiest films I've ever seen.
Okay.
But if you want your true depictions of Australian life, it's based on a set of crimes that happened and it through its narrative it looks at the socioeconomic reasons why these things happen. And it's a profoundly disturbing film.
Yeah,
but anyway. Let's talk.
I am all packed because tomorrow I'm flying off to Copenhagen. And I'm going to be doing my big ultra race this weekend. So,
and how far is this race?
They remeasured the course. So the official is 103 kilometers.
What's that in real distance?
One sec. That is 64 miles.
Hmm. Well, it sounds easy enough. Is it a hilly course?
No, it's not. It's so flat. They're actually calling it a sprint, which I love. So they're calling it a sprint ultra. It's about 1,000 meters of elevation, but it's kind of split up between there's a hill at the beginning and there's a hill at the end, and it's kind of split between those two, and then it's basically flat trail everywhere else.
Trail, 64 miles of trail.
Yeah.
Oh,
so it's on the Swedish coast. So it ends up in a town called, I don't know how you pronounce it in Swedish, but it basically spells bastard. So it's like bastard without the R.
Well, that seems very on brand.
I thought it was. And it's also my birthday. So it'll be, so I start on Friday night and then it's my birthday on Saturday. So it's a nice kind of a little birthday treat.
Have you got any supporters going?
No, but my coach will actually be there. So he's doing the race as well. So I'll be hanging out with him for a bit.
And is he going to leave you for dead?
Oh, for sure. For sure. I've been looking at his Strava, and he lives in Italy, actually. He used to live in Amsterdam, but he lives in Italy now. And like, just his average long run is like in the mountains and, you know, 3,000 meters of elevation, and it's still faster than me on the flat. So yeah, he's
you
a speedy.
Know, you say that, right? But this will sound odd, but you know, back when I used to run, I was really, really solid on hills, slow as anything on the flat. You know, having the muscle for the hills just means that you can maintain your speed.
It's definitely different muscles, and descending fast is a skill in itself. Which is why living in Amsterdam makes it really hard to train for like hilly races, because there's no hills here. And even if I do a treadmill, that's only going up. I can't go down. So the quad, my quads. So I've got to do like a load of kind of kettlebell squats kind of stuff. So it is its own skill, and it's definitely different muscles running on the flat than running on the hills and stuff. But yeah, look, I'm aiming to finish. I'm not aiming to race. So I'm kind of looking at a 15-hour kind of finish time.
I've got to let the dog out. Do you want to talk about running for a sec? I'll be right back.
I'll just talk to myself then. I'll talk to the listeners. So I'm feeling massively underprepared. I'm feeling overweight. So yeah, I think if I was to go back and do the training again, or the training plan again, I'd do a lot more strength work, a lot more core work, and actually focus on the diet rather than just kind of thinking about the diet. So we'll see what happens there. And then what else? Yeah, so it's gonna suck. It's gonna suck. I don't feel prepared, but I'm finishing the race, so I'm just mentally braced for 15 hours in the pain cave, and we'll see what happens.
Oh man, I'm gonna have to listen to the episode now. This must be what it's like to be you.
No, you need to take a week off, mate. You need to just go on holidays.
You could take for those 15 hours. You could download the episodes that you haven't been on and just play them back to back, and that would cover that and the flight home.
The batteries wouldn't last. It's the thing. So I will be bringing headphones. I'll be saving them for like the last 20-30k.
Although, as the great Dean Karnassus once told me, he said, music is the devil's tool for runners.
So just a couple of things. So I typically train without headphones. So when I use headphones, it's the same way I train without eating, like no gels or anything like that. So when I do take it, it feels like I'm cheating. It's such a treat. But there's definitely days when I really don't want to go for a run. Just like, I just can't be arsed. But then I go, all right, you know what? I'll listen to some music. Or my favorite is to put on a podcast. And for the really bad runs, what I'll do is there's a podcast. There's a Jocko Willink. I don't know if you know Jocko. The Jocko podcast, it's called. And he's like this ex-Navy SEAL badass kind of dude, right? And he brings in like these retired, like Navy SEAL special forces guys, and he interviews them about their books and their life and all this kind of stuff. And so it's very hard to feel sorry for yourself when you've got this like absolute lunatic in your ears talking about staying on the warpath and, you know, just really hardcore kind of mental strength type stuff. And that's just an easy 3 hours. Then you're just like, yeah, this is fine. And by the end of it, you want to buy all his supplements and start doing Brazilian jiu-jitsu and just buy everything he's selling. It's hilarious.
This is why I wear my Terry Fox coin around my neck.
Exactly.
That reminder that, you know, I've got two legs and no tumors in my lungs. So how much can this suck, really?
Yeah. I had that happen to me one day.
Leg and tumors in your lungs.
Oh, shut up. Basically, I was out for a run. Absolutely just pity party. Just, this sucks. I suck. I am choking. One sec. Sorry, it was a bit of banana in my protein shake. Absolute pity party. just feeling super sorry for myself, fucking miserable, whatever. And running into the woods, and coming out of the woods was somebody with two artificial legs out for their run. And they were just doing their thing. And then it's like, yeah, Fintan, shut up. You're fine. This is easy. And there is that reminder of, I think your brain can be really good. I've definitely seen this where like my brain will like try and give me an excuse to stop. So like and it's not just like, oh, you're tired. Like my knee will feel a bit funny, or my ankle, or it'll feel like I'm getting a stitch. And if I can just ignore it and keep running, it magically disappears.
Yeah, your brain will try and make you pause.
Oh, it'll give you any excuse. Oh, it's cold, or oh, you got that big thing tomorrow, you don't want to be too tired, or like it'll just run through a whole kind of thing of like just giving you every out possible. It feels like your knee's going, you better stop. So anything. So just getting comfortable ignoring that is definitely something I've worked on.
I told you my artificial leg story, didn't I?
No.
I was on a train and there was a chap who he took his prosthesis off to, you know, give his leg a rub and stuff like that. And the conductor was coming down and I said to him, quick, put your foot on the seat and see if he tells you to get your feet off the seat. He thought it was amusing, but the look I got from the other passengers was fucking death. It's highly amusing. But listen, there's this story that I wanted to share.
Go on. Right? Here we go.
And it's got nothing to do with anything, but it's been in my head. And I thought, oh, I've forgotten what a wonderful story that is. So my mate Fred stops me in the street the one day and he goes, John, have you heard anything about my son recently? Any gossip or anything like that? And I'm like, no, but, you know, nobody tells me any gossip anyway. Why? And he says, well, he said my son, and his son's a lovely guy, ridiculously handsome. He's a scaffolder. He's built, you know, and he is a lovely fella. And they're just such a nice family, actually. And his son had, his son had been out on the lash on Christmas Eve. And he was out with a lady friend and, you know, things progressed. And in Ludlow, there are a couple of pubs right by the church. The church is the largest parish church in Europe. I mean, it's cathedral sized. It's magnificent. You got these two pubs backing onto it, appropriately enough. And they, you know, they start fooling around and they decide to go find somewhere quiet. Well, it's Christmas Eve, so there are nighttime services in this colossal church. And the quiet spot they found happens to be on the church roof because it's being repaired. And so the scaffolding all up on it. So they go up onto the scaffolding and they're having a fine old time. And there's a church full of people who can hear them.
Over the service.
Oh, yeah. I would think if you get the right spot. Get the right spot, get the right time, yes. So the police are called.
Because it sounds like a murder or
and
something.
And the police rock up with their torches and all of that, and they're like, what the fuck's going on? They're knowing just how many people they've disturbed. Put on his trousers up, he looks down, there's a copper, and apparently he just looked down at the copper and he just goes, it's all right, lads, I'm a scaffolder.
Poor girl.
Fabulous. Good times.
Hilarious.
So I got this email the other day, right?
Did you? You had a lot of emails.
I do, and a lot of shit in there. I'm not saying this one shit, but there's digital identity security specialist IDCrypt Global have revealed that just a third of gamblers make use of online safety features such as deposit or time restrictions that help prevent them from gambling too much or for too long. 68% of gamblers never make use of online safety features. Now, I was thinking why that might be. And do you know the conclusions that I have come to?
If it's a global thing, a lot of the global brands, like the offshore brands, don't offer it. So it's not actually available.
Well, that's a good call. But no, that wasn't one of my thoughts, because I was just assuming that everybody was playing nice. No. What I was thinking is that, and this is the old problem. Nobody thinks that it applies to them, but I don't have a problem.
Well,
and the other facet of it is the positioning of these tools.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're generally, you know, it's as few clicks as you can get into deposit and play.
Yeah.
Right? That makes sense. That's where you want your customer. And it's a longer journey to come go around the side and do the tools and then come in the other entrance. And it's not a part of the entrance process. It's a process of its own generally. And I think that's part of the issue there. Just my thoughts.
So look, I think Sarah Ramanowska has had the amazing point that stuck, well, many amazing points. The one that really stuck with me is all gamblers are risk takers.
Yeah.
That's just it. And which goes to your point of, oh, this doesn't apply to me. All right. And I think there's a thing there. I think the, you know, a lot of good brands will make it part of the sign-up flow. So as you're registering, it's kind of all part of, it's just set as that. It could also just be set as default. You know, there's nothing stopping an operator just deciding if somebody doesn't have it, we're going to set a default that's safe. And then, you know, take it from there. But I'm not actually surprised at the numbers.
I'm surprised it's that low. That high. I'm surprised that it's not less gamblers. Fewer gamblers.
Oh, okay. I thought it'd be more. It should be everybody, right? Should be there.
Because the correct answer is 100%. But as our guest in this episode says, most of the time when people are protesting about something, it's just because it's new and they haven't done it yet, or they feel like having a piss and a moan, or pretending that they have some control. I mean, I might be putting some words in there.
You're definitely extrapolating. But it's, you know, it's like, think about, I don't know, your favorite app makes a change. Like Facebook rolls out some update. And then everyone's up in arms of, this has ruined Facebook and whatever. So there's always, people don't like change. Like, that's just human nature. I think it's more a case of, this doesn't apply to me, or I don't have a problem, or I'm in control is the answer, which is why just a default setting makes a lot of sense. But given how big and how many operators across how many jurisdictions, across how many different legislation types that they're working to, I'm not surprised the numbers where it's at.
Yeah. I knew you'd come at this like a grown up.
Sorry, man.
With your thinking, your ways. Do you know who does accept change in a begrudging sort of way? Is runners.
Do they? Why?
They do. I think you'll find that you can't buy the same running shoe 3 years in a row.
Oh, for sure. That's just
fucking annoying, isn't it?
Yeah. Well,
you find a shoe that doesn't injure you, and then you find you can't buy it anymore.
Yeah. Or they opt, or it's the same brand, same name, but they've tweaked it.
Oh, because they've got to bring out the worst. That is the worst.
They've got to bring out a new model.
But it's advertised as a tweak and an improvement. But as every runner is individual, it is not that for most people.
No.
And I've always found that really, really annoying. It's like, if you want to improve it, make it a new model. Let me have
but,
the old one.
But you can see the issue as well, right? Because if you make it, like, then you end up with how many models, how many SKUs, that becomes
unmanageable. But it'll encourage them to do it less. They'll just be, oh, we've got these five improvements. Well, there's your new model every 3 years instead. phase one out if everybody migrates. You know, it's more, it's reacting to what your customers are doing instead of forcing shit on them.
But they'll never, you'll never keep everybody happy. There's always going to be, oh, it's, I prefer this.
I don't care about everybody, Fenton.
It's a tricky, like from the business perspective, like from a runner perspective, I actually went through a phase where I deliberately changed shoes every time I had to change shoes. Like I would just pick something completely different. So I just got used to running on anything.
But are you a neutral runner?
I am now.
Whoa, we opened a can of worms there.
So I used to pronate. But the problem for trail running is there's no, all trail running shoes are neutral.
Of course. Because the ground isn't.
Exactly. So I've just been running on neutral shoes for a long time and just doing lots and lots and lots of running drills. And I've got myself from basically neutral. I'm not quite. I can definitely, if I get lazy, I can definitely pronate.
I think you're going to get lazy this weekend.
Oh, for sure.
I think your form might disappear at some point.
Oh, it's going to fucking, mate. It's going to be horrible. It's just going to be absolutely horrible this weekend.
Well, I certainly hope that we can get a full race report next week.
Totally fine. Obviously, I'm never doing that again. But yeah, it's going to be, it's just going to, and the weather, like it's going to be 30 kilometer hour winds, rain.
Oh, that's perfect.
It's going to be properly brutal.
I know, but it is perfect because
I'm not going to get too hot, which to be honest with you, the bad weather suits me better than the heat.
100%. All marathon records generally are set in cool temperatures or in cool climates. And the bulk of the energy that you use when you're running is regulating your body temperature, which sounds daft to people that have never done it, but it is true.
But it also, it can, when it's cold as well, the problem with cold is if you have to walk, you plummet really quickly. So you've got to keep moving. You've got to keep moving. Otherwise it gets very dangerous.
So you could die.
Not really. Like no, I've literally, I mean, like the man,
a bit of spice for the listeners.
I could die. I'm not going to die. I could get really fucking cold though.
But is your will and everything, is that all in order?
I had to do that before MDS last year. My wife, I hadn't told my wife, but she figured out that somebody died the year before I did my one. And so we did like, you know, here's all the passwords. Here's the bank accounts. Here's who to call if I don't make it. And here's the will. We did all that before the thing. So she's set.
Crikey.
I know. She's like, oh, there's not
a modern adventurer.
There's not many mountains in this one. She thought you were going to do something bigger. She's shagging me on.
We're going to do something a bit more dangerous.
Yeah.
Does it cross many roads?
Not in the Arctic Circle. What about like?
She's going to be online searching for your next adventure. I would expect her to sign you up for Badwater while you're in Sweden. I think it's going to happen.
It'll be fine. It's not going to be fine. I'll get it done, and it's going to suck.
You better.
No, I have to. I've got plan. I have to finish this race because I need the points for UTMB. Have you seen all
the new UTMB?
You see all the scandal? What they did?
What scandal? What?
Oh, so UTMB. So this Chinese company bought Ironman a few years ago. Bought the Ironman company. So Kona and all the Ironman events, the triathlon events. They've also bought UTMB.
Oh.
So what they did, well, one of the first things they did was they got rid of all of the qualifying races for UTMB. So typically most trail runs, most significant ultra races around the world were considered qualifying races for UTMB, which would earn you points, which you could use for the lottery. And the more points you had, the more tickets you had. What they've done now is they've kind of consolidated the qualifying races. So they created the UTMB World Series. So basically, to qualify for UTMB in Mont Blanc. So for those who don't know, UTMB is it's Ultra Trail Mont Blanc. It's the Mont Blanc mountain range in Italy, Switzerland, France, and it's like the World Cup of ultra running. So it's considered particularly in Europe, it's one of the top in the world and definitely the number one in
But
Europe
it's
ultra.
one of the most participated in. There's probably a better way I could have phrased that. It's about 3,000 runners, isn't it?
But it's also all the top runners. So all the top people
Yeah.
will come here, and it's an amazing race.
Jim won finally.
Finally, yeah. But the way he runs is crazy. He runs like he's just stolen something. It's unbelievable.
He runs the same way Paula Radcliffe used to. It's like if you're going to win, you're going to hurt.
But
Like
he, but
if you're
he.
going to beat me, you're going to really pay a high price to beat me.
But then typically he blows up three quarters of the way through, so
Yeah, it's not without its flaws.
there's a pacing issue. But the so they've created their own series of races, or they've taken over races in different countries, and so they've kind of expanded out. So the one I'm doing in Sweden is a UTMB World Series race, so it's all UTMB branded and stuff like this. But they did one. There's a ultra runner in America called Gary Robbins, who's famous for failing the Barclay Marathons. So there's an amazing documentary. If you look up Gary Robbins, David Yang on YouTube, there's an amazing documentary on YouTube about his attempt at the Barclay, two attempts at the Barclay Marathons. And beautiful, beautiful cinematography. Great story. He runs, or he's been running he's a race director in Whistler, in wherever that is in America, or Canada, or America, wherever it is. And Whistler changed all the planning permission rules and basically forced him out from running his race. And then UTMB have swooped in and are basically running the exact same race on the same weekend, but now they own it. And there's a huge backlash, and they're calling for a boycott of UTMB and all this kind of stuff. So it's ultra running as a local, we do this because we love running type
A non-corporate
business.
thing, which is what it's been for decades.
Yeah, very non-corporate, very anti-corporate. Like I look at the Netherlands, so like there's two or three crowds that run stuff here in the Netherlands, and they just love running, and it's a very community-driven thing, and it's very, very local, and very proud of their area or their countryside. And then versus that, you've got this kind of corporate colossus, which is literally just in profit maximization mode of we're going to create a global ultra running brand and maximize our returns. So it's an interesting one. But so one thing, so one of my goals was to run UTMB and do these qualifying races, but maybe there are other races in Mont Blanc, so maybe I'll look at something different. Anyway, long story, long backstory. It's all I could tell that quicker,
Crikey.
but
Now, I did see it all blown up on Twitter a bit yesterday.
it's been going on all week.
but I'm not on there much. Me and social media, we don't mix well. Oil and water. I'm not sure which one I am.
Flammable. You're the oil, man. You're the oil.
That's right. I bring the heat.
Floating the pot.
So, this episode, we're joined by Jeremy Lever. Head of gaming at Armalytics, because he wanted to talk about open banking and stuff and
He did, and
frictionless checks.
it was really interesting. So we've obviously had a few. We've had Tom Farrell from ClearStake,
Charles Cohen, Department of Trust.
Department of Trust. So we've had a few different companies on which are operating in this space. Everyone's got their take and approach on this, and I think it shows the evolution or the solution space available for these affordability checks, AML checks, etc. I think Jeremy's perspective again is kind of they've got their approach. It's a really interesting perspective. I really liked his concept of consent and the consent journey. I think that's really a really neat way of describing it and thinking about it from the user's perspective.
It's a nice catchphrase.
It's a great catchphrase. Say what you say. And I think it's a really, yeah, I just like it as a framework to work from. Okay, what is the consent we're asking for, and what are we doing? And I think he's got some really, really good points around it's new versus what's it going to look like in 3 years' time. And there's some really, really, really interesting things. So yeah, it's a super smart guy. A lot of experience. They're doing some really cool stuff, and it was, yeah, super enjoyable.
I've just learned two things from my email. One is that there is a video game developer in Wales called, I believe it's called Wales Interactive, and they've just received some funding to develop a game based on Welsh folklore. I mean, there's an audience for
Great.
everything. I'm sure it'll actually
Great.
be very good. And I've also learned that In the Heart of the Sea is now streaming on Prime. I do get some useful emails. It's not all crap.
Nice.
Have you seen In the Heart of the Sea? Well, nor have I. That's why it's interesting. But I've read the book. If you haven't read the book, read the book.
That's, you know me and books, mate. It's yeah.
Hope.
I still haven't read your book. Oh,
So,
you know what I'm gonna do? You know what I'm gonna
what?
do?
What?
Oh, I've got an idea. I've got an idea. I've got an idea.
What?
So
What?
the book you bought me,
Oh,
right?
back in July.
The Illusions by Liz Hyder, right? It's one of those, it's a beautiful book. It's a beautifully written book. And I was reading a couple of pages at a time, and what I really wanted to do is I wanted to, like, on a holiday, just sit down and read a book. And read this
Wow.
book, right? I've got stuff on my Kindle or whatever. I'll read a few pages at nighttime and then I'll fall asleep, kind of thing. I didn't want to do this because it's such a good book. But I've got 2 days where I'm going to be just sitting around doing nothing, waiting for this race to start.
What a time to be alive.
It's the perfect. I'm just going to sit on the bed in the hotel room and just fucking read this book. There we go.
Well, now you will be tested.
How exciting.
So listen, right, in the Heart of the Sea, I'm just going to drop this in very quickly. It's one of those historical kind of biographical things. It's about the whale ship Essex, which is a ship that was attacked by a sperm whale.
All
And this
right.
was a generation before Herman Melville became a whaler. So he heard the story and wrote Moby Dick. And it was a real incident. And he's this guy, Nathaniel Philbrick. He was the, I don't think he still is, but he was the director of the Whaling Museum at Nantucket. And so he's taken, I think it's three disparate sources, well, not disparate sources, but he's taken a few different sources. One of them was the Journal of the Cabin Boy, one was the Diary of the Captain, plus his own historical knowledge to put together this narrative. And it's a phenomenal book. It's really wonderful. It's about these guys getting absolutely mullered by this gigantic whale. It's about the industry, it's about the time, and it's about surviving at sea and all the crazy shit they had to do. It's a really good book. I'm sure the movie isn't going to be as good.
Have you heard about the whales have started attacking ships again?
That's killer whales generally.
Yeah, but it's off the coast of Gibraltar. So they reckon what's happened is one whale got struck by a boat, right? Didn't die or anything, but got injured by a boat or a yacht or whatever it was. And now he's rounded up his mates, and they're now hunting yachts and capsizing yachts for sport.
They could just be socialists.
Could be a US plot against oligarchs or something. But
It's time, you
it's
know, it's time for us all to rise up. Let's just follow the whales.
and then there was this one pod doing it, but now it's starting to, I don't know if they, I don't know, WhatsApp each other or whatever, but now other pods are starting to hunt yachts and
That's kind of cool.
just capsize them. So if you think about it, right, you're some oligarch billionaire, you've got the world by the balls, you've got your super yacht things just being delivered to you, you're going to take it for a spin down the Med, everything's, you've got your money out of Russia, everything's good, everything's fine, and then all of a sudden this pod of fucking killer whales comes out of
Do you know,
nowhere.
like, they're super yachts, though. I mean, they are massive, massive things. And I think if the killer whales can get the sperm whales on board, then you've got a much more even fight, because killer whale's not going to overturn a super yacht. Probably batter a regular yacht, but a super yacht, I mean, they're so big. But you start getting the sperm whales involved. You get the sperm whales involved, you might get some giant squid on board as well.
There we go.
Now you're talking.
Proper uprising from the sea, the depth.
Yeah, are you going to mess with a giant squid? Yeah, they only got footage of a giant squid in the deep, like about 10 years ago, first time. And they thought that they were these passive things just scooting around, doing giant squid stuff. They're not. When you see a sperm whales are covered in scars and marks. And that's from squid.
Really?
Yeah, well, it turns out sperm whales' favorite food is giant squid. And they'll go down and down and way down to get these things. But the squid fight back. And they don't fuck about when they're fighting back. The natural world is awesome.
But have you seen that? There was some aquarium or pet store, so something like this. And they couldn't understand why fish were going missing. And when they rolled back the tape at nighttime, when everything was done, it was an octopus or something, figured out how to get out of its tank, get across the floor into the fish tank, have a big feed, and then go back again. And apparently you've been doing it, like, I figured this out and it's just been doing it every night, just like going across, having a feed, coming back again.
That is fantastic.
No big deal.
In the words of Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park, was it Dr. Ian Malcolm? Life will find a way.
It will, man. It will.
Thanks to the late, great, that Crichton author dude for that.
Oh, Tom Crichton? No,
Michael Crichton.
Michael Crichton, that's it.
Yeah, it's good that he's remembered. Meet Jeremy Lever.
Enjoy.
We're joined by a guest so monumental that we only need one guest this week. It's not that I confused booking the other guest. It's not that the other guest has rescheduled to next week either. No. We are joined by the magnificent Jeremy Lever, who is the head of gaming for Armalytics. Jeremy, welcome.
Thank you, John.
I just want to say we do have a great week next week for guests because...
But it's a great week this week as well, John. It's a great week this week as well.
Every week's a great week.
You always do this in front of the guests. You make them feel like it's, you know, this is a great week.
Just built me up and then shut me down.
Yeah, but I feel they balance out and you should be at a nice level. You know, negative pH. No, hang on.
Neutral. Neutral.
That's it. That's it. Neutral pH. Yeah. Thanks, Fintan. Thank God you're here. Something you learned in chairman school. Do you ever? Oh no, I was going to make a toilet paper joke, but I can't because it won't necessarily work for an international audience. Chairman school, charming school, charming. That toilet paper with the bear.
Great. Good work, John.
No, but I didn't do it because I didn't think.
I know, but you thought it. You thought it. Thanks for holding back.
Yeah, yeah. I'm working towards a day when I don't say much at all, because I'd have thought it and then thought no.
Wow, this when you like ascend to the Buddha kind of thing, isn't it?
It's going to be a big day. It's going to be my personal rapture journey. And as I ascend, I'm just going to be waving to you and fucking Chairman Scooby. Bye, Fintan.
That's fine, mate. I'm not worried about that.
No, of course not. Of course not. As you sit there like Scrooge McDuck. Wiping your ass with $100 bills. Which you haven't even adjusted for the exchange rate. You know, they're just... But anyway, so Fintan and I are very pleased to have you here, Jeremy. We did talk a bit before we press record about what we were going to talk about, but I've forgotten a lot of it already. So what is it that's boiling your piss?
So Armalytics are one of three companies, really, that have designed a game in specific open banking solution for the industry. And one of, I think one of the things we all grapple with is this false notion of friction versus frictionless that's been peddled, you know, from the right, from the top, the government, you know, to the Gambling Commission, and then some of the media outlets and the BGC. And I think we've lost track of what a consent journey is and actually how important that, you know, those consent journeys exist. So that's a big thing that, you know, a big bee in my bonnet.
So, probably just for the uninitiated, and it's a nice. Well, I don't know what the phrase is I'm looking for. I'm probably just going to make up a really harsh one now. I love the phrase consent journey because I love kind of gimmicky catchphrases. I think they're just fucking brilliant. And like consent journey is, that's a new one for me today. And I'm delighted to make its acquaintance. What is a consent journey? I mean, can it be applied to the wider society?
Jesus Christ.
What? Inquiring minds want to know.
So, yeah, I mean, look, consent is when you've consented to hand over, you know, some of your most personal information, whether that's your name, your email address, your date of birth, your mobile telephone number. So my background is I've always worked for early stage startups and scale ups. And I kind of fell into the gaming sector by accident because I used to sell to financial service to banks and the gambling industry. And I've never been a gambler. I don't gamble at all, really. I play the national lottery. There's a huge EuroMillions jackpot. Who doesn't? And I fell into it because I was closing the biggest contracts and it was just the most interesting area. There was a lot of change and started around 2016, just before for MLD, the Money Laundering Directive, came into force. And then more recently, I worked at Experian, which is the largest credit reference agency in the UK and in the world, actually. And that's where I really understood what a consent journey is. So a lot of the conversations around this at the moment sits around the impending white paper changes, right? So we've got the problem gambling, £1,000 loss within 24 hours or £500 if it's a younger age bracket, and then £2,000 around the loss chasing or £1,000 for the younger age group. So what I learned at Experian was, and I hadn't thought about it before, in any way, that when you sign up for a gambling account, you're going through a consented journey. We've just got so used to doing it that we're not doing it. So you fill out a form typically, and you give your name, your email address, your date of birth, and then you sign up for an account. And what happens in that split second when it goes into the next page, assuming that it's a successful, what's called an EKYC check, is they're checking against the bureau, right, to check, to authenticate your identity, that this is you and that you're alive. And that leaves a soft print against the consumer file. So most people don't think about that. It's not a hard footprint, so it's not like other lenders and banks and things can see this against the bureau, but there is still a print and a footprint of some sort left against your consumer file. So we don't really know what the full implications of that are. So when, you know, you talk about the open banking journey and, you know, it doesn't matter who you speak to, they always talk about this friction and you know, whether players that like to be asked questions, but in truth, there's just a lack of understanding of what the process is. And that obviously, like with anything, your bank information is as valuable as your name, your personal, where you live, your residential address, and your mobile number and your email address. So I think the industry's lost track of what a consented journey is. And yeah, it's I think in 3 or 4 years' time, you know, this won't even be a conversation around open banking and doing those checks that can happen manually as well. There'll still be some people that want to manually share documents. So I don't know whether that answers your question there, John or Finta, whether you've got any further thoughts or whether you've had similar conversations.
So I'm trying to... So I get your point on the kind of the soft check that happens kind of auto-magically in the background as you're registering.
Yeah.
And they're also doing other checks to make sure you're not a fraud account or bonus abuser or
exactly
whatever. So there's a bunch of stuff going on in the background automatically. I'm assuming, and I suppose in a way, I could be wrong, but there's no like, we're about to look you up on these various databases. Please tick this box to agree button on that registration form. It just happens.
That's right. If you were to look in the terms and conditions,
yeah,
it would detail what's
but it's not an but it's not an explicit. Yeah, nobody reads the T's and C's, right? So it's not an explicit. Exactly. Hey, we're going to check you against the electoral roll and a credit reference agency or whatever the checks are.
Exactly.
From an open banking perspective. Or like from a, like, can you afford this perspective, affordability, I'll use the right word.
Yeah.
Given that it's touching your bank account, which is not public data, where say the electoral roll or your credit file is, I believe is the difference, that'd be the distinction. Obviously then that's an extra layer of data sharing that people probably don't want to do or would initially feel uncomfortable doing or would normally hesitate about. So what I'm trying to join out your point of like in 3-4 years time, people aren't even going to think about this. Is that what you think is going to happen? Like it's just right now, this is new and different, a bit like driverless cars. And then all of a sudden it's going to be super normal and nobody's going to think about it anymore.
Yeah, I'd say it's going to be more normal before driverless cars, hopefully.
Well, I'm just using that as an example. Like when Google first announced driverless cars, it's like, this is crazy. We're all going to die. Yeah. This is never going to work.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden there's like robo taxis driving around San Francisco.
Yeah, yeah. No, look, your point is absolutely valid. So I think it's a point about, you know, a new process that will become normalized. Mm-hmm. Also with open banking, you're already sharing the data. You're in control of your data and you're sharing that data with the operator. Mm-hmm. And they can only hold it for, you know, a limited amount of time and for a specific purpose.
Mm.
Right. So that's, it's actually more secure to share through open banking. And in order to be an open banking provider, there's really strict regulation in the UK. So you can either, you can use a host. So you can use someone like EcoSpend Technologies, Trustly, and then leverage their services. Or you mm-hmm. can apply for an independent FCA, Financial Conduct Authority license, which is what we have. And there's various steps you have to go through there. So you have to be FCA regulates to be an open banking provider.
Okay, so let's just on the just dive into that a little bit. So I've worked as an affiliate for however many years now, and every affiliate manager in the industry has a copy of my passport and proof of address and a bank statement.
Yeah.
Right, as kind of company led KYC, AML, know your affiliate type stuff. And like tough shit, Fintan. Like that's it. Where what you're saying is under an open banking perspective, I would have control of who has access to that, for how long they have access to that, and I can revoke access to that at some point rather than my details potentially ending up on the dark web.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Absolutely right. I mean, since I think there was a big data leak with Equifax a few years back.
Mm-hmm.
This is 2008, and I know from working at Experian, they've got very strict data protocols now. So, you know, I think emails get deleted every 3 or 6 months. I can't quite remember now. So it's less likely to happen. But essentially, yeah, you know, it's only you have open banking is quite interesting. I suppose it's a revolution of your own data. You know, you can absolutely revoke access, and you can choose what data you want to share as well with the operator or any other regulated business. So, you know, we as a company, we have 6 different sectors and 200 direct customers, and everyone from, you know, banks, law firms, accountants, there's a number of companies we work with, and it's the same approach. And I think once you go through an open banking journey, you understand that it's safe and it's quicker and convenient, then, you know, it's not something you really think about using.
Okay, so I'm just going to jump on that. So there's a website called haveibeenpawned.com. I've just put in my email address, and my data has been stolen in 27 data breaches.
Oh my God. Can you see?
Including.
Yeah.
Like if we look at it just from a gambling perspective, including Moneybookers, NetTeller, and Paddy Power. Now, some of this is going back to like 2010, right? So it's But there's Twitter, Tumblr. What else we got? Under Armour, LinkedIn, Kickstarter, Elance, Dropbox, Deezer. Bitly app, whatever the fuck app it is. Anyway, so it's like this happens, right? Your data gets stolen all the time.
Yeah.
So if you've banged across your bank details and whatever data, and it's just sitting on somebody else's servers for an indefinite period of time, statistically, something bad's going to happen.
Yeah, so this is why in terms of open banking, you can only store the data for a very limited amount of time, and it varies, you know, from operator to operator. We all have slightly different approaches as well about how we use the data. So we can access up to 2 years of data, but all of this is clearly signposted when you start the journey. And the key point here is that whatever regulated business you are, you have to, we are data controllers, and the operators are data control as well. You have to use the data for a specific purpose. Some of those examples you've given, your data has been used for additional purposes, because back then, you know, we didn't think about data in the way that we do now. Mm. I think that is a historical issue. I mean, that's, you know, going back, you know, 13 years now. So, you know, we are living in a different world, and that, you know, that is a fair concern. But and that's why open banking is FCA regulated.
Mm. So John's email address would have been breached 14 times.
He's still on the same site.
Including MGM Resorts in 2022.
What's this site? Pawn.com?
No, you've got to be careful how you say that.
With a W. With a
yeah.
W.
Have I been pawned? So PWNED.com.
I've got a stupid question. Well, it might be a stupid question. It might not. But you know how that goes, Fintan, right?
I'm
going to ask it anyway.
Go for it.
Where's open banking come from?
From the financial services sector.
Okay, why? what was it? It was created, presumably, in a need for something. And it's an expression that probably covers quite a lot of things. Because it's not like a proprietorial thing, is it? It's like it's a bunch of stuff that makes something easier. Why did it come about?
So that's a good question, and quite a tricky question to cover in this amount of time. But broadly speaking, it was devised because the banks wanted a more secure, more cost-effective way for consumers to be able to, you know, share and control their data. But that's quite a big question, John. We could be here for quite a long time. It's a good question.
I guess. I, the, I mean,
The exact summary from what I understand, it's a big part of it was an EU initiative for data sharing and to stimulate kind of fintech and cross-border payments and just improve the banking system overall. And it kind of came along around the same time as MiFID II, which had a load of regulations around selling different securities and the documentation. So it's probably not
a coincidence that this is coming up while the EU is putting so much effort into the next generation of AML rules, right?
It'd all be part of that timeline, yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, it's a really natural fit for the gambling industry, fundamentally, isn't it? I mean, it's because no matter where you are, even in the let's never forget this, you used to be able to get a Curacao license free in a box of Rice Krispies. And now they're saying, no, you were going to actually have laws and it won't be, have I got lucky today? Even in places like Curacao, they're going to be ramping up the AML and all, this is happening pretty much everywhere. So why isn't this broadly adopted? I feel like I'm missing something here, because if it's good for AML, then it fits across RG. If it makes moving money easier and quicker. Yeah. And it's probably cheaper. Why is
everybody
using this?
Yeah. So if your question is about adoption, and this is an interesting question. If that's basically where you were going with this, John. So most people, open banking is not that new, and I think most people are not aware that they're using open banking at the moment. So if you look at the stats, there's 93% in the UK. This is just for the UK. So 93% of people have access to online banking, and 40% of those people are actively using open banking in their day-to-day lives. If you look at the age groups as well, which is interesting, I think it's between 55 to 65 as the most active open banking users. And I think it's more a case that people they're not aware that they're using open banking in their day-to-day. And open banking is really, if you have banking apps on your phone, and I use Monzo, right, for my commuting to the office twice a week, and then I've got my main Barclays account. Every time I move money through the apps, through my Monzo app from my Barclays account and vice versa, that's just a simple open banking journey. So it is actually quite widely adopted. It's just that, and we've got some interesting, so we work with remote and non-remote land-based casinos as well. And it's really interesting. So when we do the, trials or proof of concepts, you separate the groups and you have one group that says, you can send us your documents, the old-fashioned way, you can upload your documents, or you can use an open banking journey. And with the other group, we say, can you share, upload your documents, or we've got this new digital journey, we'll try that. It's not a surprise that the latter group has a much higher uptake. So I think, signposting open banking, particularly in the gaming sector, is, whilst we're at this early adoption period, will impact conversion. But yeah, I mean, once you've been through a journey once, it's a no-brainer when you do it again, right? Because you can do it on the spot. It's the safest and quickest way to do it.
And in terms of those convert, because obviously we've had a wide spectrum of people on the show, we're trying to get somebody on it. If you read the Racing Post, it's very much a case of, it's not going to be frictionless. Most people are going to say fuck you, and they're going to go to offshore sports books or offshore casinos,
and then we'll all catch fire.
When somebody think of the children. And then obviously the counter argument is no, it'll be frictionless. And I think literally, British PM today announced to the racing community that it would be frictionless or something. Yeah. Unless I hallucinated that while I was eating my lunch. Which is also quite possible. I'm having a week.
Did you have any mushrooms on your lunch?
I fucking hate mushrooms. So obviously you've got kind of, and you know, the truth's always somewhere in the middle, right? Yeah. That's just, it's yeah. never. So I suppose based on your experience and the date, like what is the dropout rate or what is the refusal rate and how does that compare to, because obviously, you know, operators are doing these checks now anyway.
Yes.
For, okay, different thresholds.
Yeah.
But they are doing these checks. What do you see? Like what's the data saying? Let's get the facts on the table.
Yeah. 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 So that, look, it's a really interesting question. So I think we need to start with the volumes first, right? Mm-hmm. So the industry, Andrew Rhodes's figure around the 3%, mm-hmm. right? Concern is that's not actually accurate. So it's really if you look at problem gambling and loss chasing, it's a 0.3-0.5%. It's the 10% of the 3%. So it's not mm-hmm. going to be 3% of all accounts. So that's the first point to make there. So the checks are more proportional than anyone really realizes. The second point is, look, open banking isn't the silver bullet. So what I've seen, most operators we speak to, and if you look at the remote industry on its own, there are about 200 or so licensed regulated operators in the UK. You've got about 5 that are tier ones. You've got about 60 that are tier twos, and everyone else are tier threes. Mm-hmm. Now, with regards to the tier ones, the tier twos, most of those will have some sort of open banking in place. The process will be quite broken, and they'll be using quite a rudimentary open banking solution. So, you know, the league that we sit in is with Department of Trust and ClearState, because we've all developed our own interpretations of a gaming-specific open banking journey. So it depends where you look. And the other thing to talk about, so we come at it from a Source Funds ML perspective, which is not covered in the white paper, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So if you look at affordability, there's a big drop-off because the player's typically loss-making, pissed off. So from the player's perspective, they're like, well, you know, you haven't spoken to me really until now, and you're going to freeze my account unless I send the bank statement. So, you know, F you sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
With an AML check, which can happen at the beginning of the journey, not just the end of it, the player can often be in a positive net position. They might just want to deposit more. You know, there's a similar drop-off. So either point, you're looking at anywhere between an 80 to 90% customer total drop-off. In other words, you know, F you guys, I'm not coming back. I'm off to the black market, whether they do or not.
But are they really off to the black market, or are they just off to another bookie?
Yeah, well, that's it. So from what we can see from our data and the conversation, look, there's a lack of data on this, okay? So we don't really know. Now, if you're a big hitter, you know, are you going to go to the black market? There's a regulator, you could lose all of your money. Wouldn't it be better to, and a lot of these people have been through this process more than once with the tier ones and the tier twos. So they're not the type that say F you. It's more that if the operator was taking too long, which if you listen to what the rating posts are talking about, it's the going back and forth of the data, right? So actually that is where the friction is building up. Okay. So, yes. Yeah, so you need to, if you break this down a bit further, so it's a bit more complicated, but generally speaking, where there's a 90% drop off at the manual requests for documents with open banking, what we're seeing is between a 250% to 300% increase of customers sending back their documents. So that's what we're seeing at the moment, and it's still
okay. So it's an improvement on the existing situation.
Yeah, that's right. It's a material improvement.
Yeah.
But you guys have had some interesting guests on your show, and you know, I think you know, Fintan, with your background, when you're selling, you know, a solution that can make a material difference, the opposing stakeholders or anyone with budget will instantly look for what's wrong with that solution, as opposed to looking at, you know, where the material gain is. So in a roundabout way, there's a lack of data around this. And when we do our POVs, the way that we suggest benchmarking success is a combination of things. The first is engagement. So how many people are sending back documents through our open banking journey than manually? The other is the speed that they're doing it. So there's a lot of tension that builds with the operators, with the back and forth, while the player wants to deposit or withdraw funds. That can be, that's where most of the friction actually is. The other metric is we call usable conversion. So, you know, how many of those customers that send back documents can then have their account unfrozen, or from an AML perspective, that they can spend what they want to spend. You know, there are some people out there that want to spend 60 grand a week on their betting, which is, I can't even imagine a world like that. But, you know, I'm six times a year Euro Millions player.
So that's the point, right? So, like, I think your point on the heavy hitters is quite interesting. So obviously the 3% has been called out in the press, or called out in the Racing Post, I should say.
Yeah.
And I think Andrew addressed it in terms of, look, it's an average, but it's not going to be the average for everybody. So like a Fitstairs, you know, I think he's very publicly said like 80-90% of our people are going to have to go through this process.
Yeah.
And then there'll be other operators where it's just like, it's less than 3%, whatever. So it'll obviously depend on the thing.
Yeah.
I think your point on heavy hitters or these kind of VIPs, realistically, a VIP is going through this anyway with a lot of service providers. So their bank, their accountant, if they engage a lawyer, if they, any kind of professional service requires AML, KYC, source of funds, depending on what's going on.
Yeah.
Exactly. So it's not like it's an unusual request that they've never encountered before in their lives.
Yeah.
And
that's right. And I think where gaming, and I mean gambling is inclusive of that, obviously, it's for the purposes of entertainment, which is where it normally gets challenged. And to be fair to the Racing Post, they have made some sound points, and I am sympathetic. You know, there was a piece earlier this week or last week around, you know, horse owners being put through the same checks, and they buy horses for hundreds of thousands of pounds. There was another chap that didn't have the same checks, apparently, when buying, you know, a flat and a powerboat. Admittedly, I had to look up what a powerboat was because I didn't know what a powerboat was.
It's fast.
And and far more impressive and expensive than I realised. And, you know, they don't have to succumb to the same checks. You could probably buy a Ferrari, which is plus £100,000, and not go through those checks.
For sure, but I think that's more a reflection of money laundering. Regulation, like, you know, money laundering in the US via property purchases via a law firm has been a massive loophole for years, and that's how the Russians have done their stuff in New York. So
allegedly.
Your Honor, that's all I hear. But I'm not up to date on everything with her. I'd love to chat with somebody there. I'm not up to date on everything they've written, for sure. So it's definitely disproportionate in some ways. The same way, like, we could go drink ourselves silly on very, very expensive wine and spend all our money on wine today.
Yeah.
And have no money tomorrow, right? That's entirely possible. Or, you know, we can go get some Wagyu Kobe beef air freighted in from Japan and have a great old meal, right? You know, we can easily go blow 50 grand on a meal.
Yeah.
If we put our backs into it.
Yeah.
So I get that, but I think my challenge to that would be the whataboutism doesn't work. Right.
Yeah.
So what about alcohol industry? What about the tobacco industry? You know, I don't think we can point fingers. I think as an industry, we have to just deal with this, but then do it in a, and I think your point of, okay, let's do it in a customer centric way. So a great example, and I'm going to go completely off topic. In the finance world, there's a thing called a Bloomberg terminal. So a Bloomberg terminal is what made Michael Bloomberg, former New York billionaire, and every trader in the world basically has access to one of these machines. And they cost about, I don't know, 20 to 50 grand a year for a license fee. I worked in a trading firm out of college, and one of the traders had a problem doing something on this Bloomberg machine. And he contacted customer support, and customer support couldn't fix it over the chat. The next morning, somebody flew in from London to Dublin, was sitting at our front door at 8 a.m. the next morning, and sat with our trader for half a day and made sure he had everything he needed. And it was probably the best example of customer service I've ever seen in my life, of just like white glove, we will make sure you've got this. Then he walked around the building, chatted with everybody else, fixed up some other stuff, and just like left such a great impression on our customer spending $500,000 a year, whatever it was, with them.
Yeah.
For the cost of a hotel and, you know, 500 quid on flights.
Yeah.
And the loyalty that builds in is insane.
Yeah.
And your point then of, okay, you've asked somebody for documentation, very personal documentation. Show me your bank statement, right? It's the most like personal thing, apart from your browsing history.
Yeah.
Like it's right up there, right? You know, show me your credit card bill, show me your bank statement kind of
that's,
stuff.
That's next year, Fintan.
That's next year. Have it. You might learn something. it's the most personal thing in the world. But then if you're turning around and saying, well, actually then there's a lot of back and forth and it's very slow and it's a very arduous process. Like from a customer service perspective, that's awful.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, you know, I mentioned before, and I've worked with a lot of operators over the years, and look, AML is the sidekick to affordability, right? It really is. It's the next step in the process. A lot of the friction that happens, if you were to ask some of the most active participants in you know their recent survey, and if you ask specific questions about what is this that is causing you issues, and they'll start by saying that, you know, their biggest thing that Tom Kerr was saying, and I have some sympathy to a degree, as the government, they're telling us how to spend our money. You know, unfortunately, in the gaming world, and I've worked with lived experience people, you know, there have been some bad examples that are historical where gambling spend has got completely out of control, right? So, yeah, from a customer's perspective, if you're a big hitter, or if you're someone that just loves, you know, loves betting on the horses, you know, these checks have been going for at least 5 years, at least. And it came from the industry initially. It was the industry's interpretation of what the Gambling Commission wanted to see when they had their forums, because, you know, the operators have been hit with these huge fines from about 2018 onwards. The industry got together and said, right, well, we have to do these checks. And you're right, if it's carried out in the right way, the, you know, we're seeing from our customers, you get a huge amount of customer loyalty. You have less, when I say customer interactions, I mean customer interactions that could cause friction, which might be, you know, that player shared their most intimate data. You know, there are a lot of people that are married that don't share bank accounts.
Yeah.
You know, you can really tell a lot about someone by looking at their bank details, right? So once you do it once and the journey has worked, the implications are very positive for the player. It's just getting over that bit of, you know, this is a consented journey. This is how we're going to do these checks from now on.
Can I build on this a little bit? Because there's potentially an opportunity here. So if you take e-commerce, right? So let's say you're out buying new headphones and you go to some, I don't know, some headphone website and you find the headphones you want. but then they're insisting that you register and you fill in all your details and you've got to create a password and you've got to verify your email address and you've got to do all these bullshit e-commerce hoops that every single e-commerce, every e-commerce website wants you to do, right?
Yeah.
I know there's been a bunch of times where I've been sitting there going, fuck it, I'll just use Amazon. Because it's got all my details, I'm verified, it's got I don't have to type. I just bang in the product I want, one click, and I've bought it.
Yeah.
Right. Just from a pure, and I'm on my phone and maybe their website, you know, the, whatever, maybe it doesn't work well on my phone. If you, if we take, you know, there's a new world where these checks are going to happen. And let's assume there is some sort of friction, right? I don't, I think frictionless is optimistic. This is just some sort of friction. If I can do that in a really good way with my customers, and we assume most UK customers have multiple accounts, the second they encounter that with somebody else or they have to go through it, they're going, you know what? I'm just going to go back to where it's already done. And so is there actually an opportunity for operators to be the ones who do it the best and kind of create that in a way? You're creating a little bit of a moat of, well, you've done it once with us. You'll never just don't
pile
even bother.
The money into being the first check they do.
Well, I don't know about being the first check. If I think about being the best check.
No, I think being the first, that what you were saying just now, oh, you know, I'll just go back to Amazon. I've already done this. They've already got my details.
Yeah.
So
but you need to, you can't just be first. You've got to have a great way of doing it and be first.
So Vincent, there are, it probably would surprise you, but a lot of the tier ones are thinking about this already. Because they've got a loyal customer base and they can get it, you know, out of the way, so to speak, from the very beginning.
Yeah.
Either at the point of account registration or at the point of deposit. Okay, so we're already having these conversations at the moment. So there's a huge opportunity there. If you think about a tier three, even a tier four perspective, and I'm just talking about remote operators, and you know this world well, Vincent, as you know, someone that has worked in the affiliate space, they're obviously in a growth acquisition mode.
Yep.
So for them, they don't have to, whilst it might be beneficial to get that data, maybe not at the very beginning, but at the start of the journey or close to, you know, the point of deposit. If you start seeing risk metrics, then obviously that impacts your customer relationship. Now, that doesn't, that's not a negative in the sense that that player, you know, you could, they, whilst they might spend less in the next 6 months, you retain them and then they end up spending more over the next 12 months, right? But a lot of operators are still in the mindset, especially they're in acquisition mode. And I don't want to trash talk the smaller operator market because it's challenging in the with the UK at the moment.
Yep.
But unfortunately, there is that still that mindset, which is, you know, let's not ask too many questions. We'll do the bare minimum what we have to, and you know, stack them up, and they've got to, you know, put them through the swimming lane process, they call them, and let their player risk evolve. So I think, yeah, it depends what sort of mode you're in, right? I mean, when people talk about the gambling industry, they think that all operators are the same, and you know, they're just not. It depends what sort of level of risk they are. It depends what, you know, whether they're one market specific, it's there are just so many nuances. But we are having these conversations already with some of the big boys about, you know, there's a lot of people that just come into an operator, drop 100 grand, and then they can't bet because they need to go through the document process.
Yeah.
Right. So obviously the more you can minimize the back and forth, and I would call it the where there's friction in the interaction, you know, you're going to have a great start with them, you know, with that customer, and you're done, right? So you're good for technically 6 months, 12 months.
Yeah. And then the refresh is kind of a, well, look, we've done this once, you know, it's painless. Let's get it done kind of thing.
And something that, just to go back to, you mentioned there, John, about Curacell. I mean, the gaming industry needs regulation, right? Not just because of some bad examples that are historic now, where, you know, the banks also failed, you know, these players and families affected. I'm not going to go into, you know, I've worked with lived experience, worked with the Bradford families, and I saw, you know, the impact on them. So I think the more regulation instills confidence. There's an event recently, and this guy was from a venture capital firm, and he was saying the industry is struggling to get the investment that they did 6 years ago before discussions of the white paper happened that have been ongoing for the last 4 years. You know, and confidence and regulation is good for the sector. This idea of a max exodus to the black market. The black market is real. And again, that's another area that I think even Rhodes, you mentioned on your show a few weeks back, there is a lack of data on this. And I think that the 96.3% channelization stat needs to be challenged. The black market is real. It's a risk. There are people at regulated operators that I know of use it. But in terms of a mass exodus, you know, like with anything, when you go on holiday or, you know, would you fly with an airline that you haven't heard of? Would you, you know, if it was really cheap, you know? So I think the impact of the black market would be minimal. I think where we need to start is educating people about data and what consent journeys are. And, you know, I think we'll be in a better place.
I think some of the data about the black market, I mean, obviously some of it comes from search analysis. But I do wonder if that was broken down by IP address, how many of those black market searches have come from the Betting and Gaming Council offices?
See,
I have to make a note to remind myself to get that right.
So I was saying to you guys before you start the show, you should get someone on from the BGC. And
we'd love to. We'd love to. Open invitation anytime they want. No yes, problems at all.
Yes, just the challenge.
Just, well, look, we've had all aspects of the industry.
But it would be really interesting. I mean, there are things I'd love to talk about, you know, because I know speaking to people privately that there are areas of the UK gambling industry that feel underserved by the BGC. You know, it'd just be interesting to ask those questions that have been put to me by their members.
Yeah, I mean, hats off to Andrew Rhodes for coming on to you guys. It was a good, really good two-part podcast. You asked him some difficult questions.
He gave us all of those questions.
Oh, right, okay, they were.
It was all scripted.
We script everything very carefully. But Jeremy obviously knows this because we've been working on this podcast for 3 days now.
It's the 15th take. It's killing me.
You're a tightly coiled spring now, Fintan.
Oh, I am.
I was just thinking, actually, while we were talking, I was just thinking, just imagine if financial checks came in to be able to use, for example, digital entertainment streaming services.
Yeah.
You know, would people not be able to see the forthcoming final season of Cobra Kai?
Oh, I thought you were going to do age verification on porn websites.
No, that's no, I wasn't. But I did nearly jump in when you were like, "Oh, John Bruford's email address has been compromised on these searches." I'm just stood there thinking, if he says fisting.com, I'm going to resign on the spot.
Is there going to be another season of Cobra Kai? Because I love that show.
It is the last season. It's coming this year, and I mean, given that it's November tomorrow, I think we can expect it to start dropping around Christmas.
Yeah, I absolutely love that show because growing up in the 80s. You know, that it's sort of Sunday afternoon TV.
But Jeremy, you've got both hair and none of it seems to be grey. So you say growing up in the 80s. Do you know what I mean? You do look
so I do have grey hair on the side.
Okay. I've only got hair on the side. So if this were top trumps, I think I'd win that one.
Yeah, 84.
Because obviously the positives are, you know, that you haven't got hair or that it's really super grey or whatever. So, Fintan, you're a loser.
Fine.
With your hair.
requirement.
You never mention it, John. You never mention it. I didn't realize it's such a sore point at all. It's never a topic of conversation.
Do you remember the movie? You both presumably know the movie Predator.
Yes. Oh, awesome. Yeah.
So I had a Predator moment the other day. Not that I was battling a giant alien creature, but I dry shaved my head.
Nice. With like a big knife kind of thing, a big combat knife.
No. But
to be fair, they were sweating in the first one.
There were two shaving moments. Sure, somebody uses a disposable at one point and somebody uses a knife at another point. But I was using a standard razor and I had no humidity to assist me.
Just your natural clamminess, is it?
Basically, yes. Yes. I just had to think about...
your tax bill.
Okay. I was just going to say HMRC and serious relationships, and suddenly it's running like a knife through melting butter.
Jesus.
Cringe moments from your history, kind of thing. Oh my God, I can't believe I said that.
I just wish I could shave for longer because I've got so many of those memories. Ah, dear. Sucks to be me. Gentlemen, I'm actually going to wrap things up there if nobody minds. I mean, unless Jeremy, you've got a favorite Kevin Costner film.
Bodyguard.
Fuck's
sake. Come on. Finally.
So, it's one of my top five films ever, actually.
There we go.
Such a liar.
No, it's not. Such a lie. No, it's not. I bloody love that film.
I'm with you. It's a great film.
Do you like John Grisham books as well, Jeremy?
So, my dad used to read these religiously on holidays.
I thought you were going to say read them to us at bedtime.
No.
Because it would work on me.
No, so I I haven't read one John Grisham book. And the only reason is my dad, when he was younger, he ran his own business, worked all the hours. So I had no time with him. And then on holiday, he would just sat there reading a bloody John Grisham book.
That's
came up my recent therapy last week.
Yeah, we're big fans of therapy on this podcast.
We are. Everyone should do therapy.
No, everyone not should. Least the fabulous lady who may or may not have cured me of my needle phobia. It's an ongoing project, but it's pretty good. She did great.
Bit of hypnotism.
Yeah, a bit of hypnotism. Yeah. I've got the recording to play back. Well, if you'd asked me beforehand, I'd have said no. But here's the weird thing, right? I am not somebody that anybody that has ever met me would describe as smiley, right? I'm saving my smiles for my retirement. And I'm walking to the surgery for this blood test. I couldn't stop smiling. And that was something that she had talked about in the session. And she'd put in the recording, there was this like reinforcement recording, and I could not stop smiling. I was sitting in there, woman's got a needle in her hand, and I'm there going, this is the best thing ever. Please puncture me.
More.
And it was like, but surely I've got two arms.
You're nothing bigger.
But it was really, really odd. And that I can only ascribe that to the hypnotism. So that's there cool. is something there.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's pretty freaky. Yeah. What about Michael Douglas?
He's I mean, come on, he's done some pretty iconic films. None that I can think of at the moment. What was the film with Sharon Stone?
Basic Instinct.
Yeah. Of course I love that for Michael Douglas, not Sharon Stone.
Well, actually, I think...
Just being honest.
I think that Basic Instinct has an actress in it who both has a fantastic name. Well, both. She's a three-way threat. She's got a fantastic name. She's ridiculously talented. And I would say she's one of the most beautiful actresses out there. And her name is Jean Triplehorn. What a fantastic name. And she's absolutely brilliant in Basic Instinct. But it's like, if you watch Basic Instinct, I mean, it's not a tremendous movie by any stretch of the imagination, but all of the supporting cast are phenomenal. That's George Zunza is Douglas's partner. Triplehorn is Douglas's ex-wife, I think. These are absolutely top-notch actors, let down by a very expensive and not particularly good script. But I love the director's work. It's Paul Verhoeven, of course.
Well, I've got really poor film taste, so Mickey Blue Eyes would make one of my top five, which most people would say is a pretty shocking film.
It is, but James Caan is my favourite actor ever.
Yeah.
He's actually terrific. That the forget about it scene in Mickey Blue Eyes is actually really, really funny.
Yeah.
James Caan. I watched that dude in anything. I have watched that dude in anything. Talk about people that have made some dodgy films. And there's a guy, if he turned a film down, it would be an almost a guarantee of success. I'm just putting into Google now, films James Caan turned down, right? Going to be a star, that's good. Brain damaged footballer, small screen, gotcha. And of course, after The Godfather, is like, this guy's going to be an absolute mega star. And he turned down, hang on, MASH, The French Connection, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Kramer versus Kramer, Apocalypse Now, Blade Runner, Love Story, and Superman.
Well, Apocalypse Now and Blade Runner, probably the only two he went wrong with.
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
Well, yeah, it's pretty good.
There's a pretty decent argument that Close Encounters of the Third Kind is Spielberg's best film. French Connection won Best Picture Oscar in, 75?
So I think your formula just about works out, John.
I love the guy, ridiculous talent, and he's the best thing about the movie Misery, no question. But Mickey Blue Eyes, it is shit, though. I was trying so hard to give you some positive feedback.
You really worked it. Okay.
I can't do it.
You're just teasing me, John. I thought you were going to say, yeah, I agree. Top 10.
No. not yet. My top 10 is bizarre. But anyway, Jeremy Lever, thank you very much for joining us on
the Fast Podcast.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
If you've enjoyed this episode of the Gambling Files podcast, please find us on LinkedIn. Give us a big, juicy, succulent like. That nearly went wrong. You can find us under the name The Gambling Files Podcast. You can find us on Twitter under The Gambling Files. I think the handle is just @GamblingFiles. You can connect to myself, John Bruford, or Fintan Costello, also on LinkedIn. We're also both on Twitter. And you can find all of our previous episodes at www.thegamblingfiles.com. If you enjoyed it, please share, tell your friends, tell your family, tell your colleagues, and we'll see you next time.